C2A. Number 8B.
All right. We come to the next subtone of life. And we have seen in the chapter of Tomen and Eucharist, life is usually the subject of laying down the mortal, laying down a false sense. That's the life sense in the Christ. Actually, that would not be the accent on life, say, in the third chapter, on the fourth chapter. It's always, every synonymous term has its accent on some specific ideas of the synonymous term in each chapter. Here we see that sense of laying down the mortal, which says you can't get out of sin into the heaven of soul if you try to drag along all everything that is wrong. You have to let it go. You have to give up the mortal sense of things. You can't go into heaven with all your nice sins and false concepts. That is not possible. So you better have to get rid of it and lay it down. So that is what we see here. We have a little bridge here first that bridges the preceding subject of principle with life. Namely, she starts out and says, justice requires reformation of the sinner. Reformation of the sinner is soul, as you know. Principle is always justice, so she brings in a little bit still of the preceding subtone of principle as justice, in order to show that there is no life or mercy without principle or justice. So we get now the two terms, justice and mercy, two very important terms. Because what is mercy? If we know the Beatitudes, then we know that's the fifth Beatitude of life. Blessed are the merciful. And at once we are feeling that now Mrs. Eddy changes the subject and goes from principle to life and says, mercy counsels the dead only when justice approves. She wants to say mercy without justice is no mercy. That mercy which says I forgive you is only mercy when in that forgiveness is a willingness to correct the situation, which is principle. Therefore, mercy without justice, which justice says you have to correct an error, then only mercy is a right attitude. So mercy counsels the dead only when justice approves, because revenge is inadmissible. Wrath, with its counterfeit of mercy, which is only appeased, is not destroyed. If it's only appeased, if it's not coupled with justice, then it is only appeased. It's not really then resolved, but is partially indulged. Therefore, wisdom and love may require many sacrifices. Can you hear? Many sacrifices. That's life. To sacrifice a mortal sense of life, a material sense of life, a personal sense of life. That it requires many sacrifices of self. Self, you know, is the counterfeit of the identity of soul, of the ego of soul, of the true selfhood of soul, of the spiritual selfhood of soul. So the personal sense of self, the material sense of self, the corporeal sense of self must be sacrificed. Soul, life. We can have not a true spiritual selfhood without sacrificing the wrong selfhood. And therefore it requires many sacrifices of self to save us from sin, to save us from sin and get into soul. Therefore one sacrifice, she had many sacrifices and says, one sacrifice, however great, is insufficient to pay the debt for sin. So indicating that that sacrifice is not just a job that you do once and then that's over. It is a constant sacrifice, really. Oh, yes, she brings it right in. Sorry. The atonement requires constant self-immolation on the sinner's part. See, if you are in the rhythm of the synonymous term, you really feel what's coming. So it says many sacrifices. So one is not enough. How many sacrifices? Constant sacrifice. Can you hear the tone repeats itself constantly on the tone of life? So again, she takes up that God's wrath with which she started. Wrath is the counterfeit of that mercy. That God's wrath should be vented upon his beloved son is divinely unnatural. She just refutes here the theological sense that theology says, well, Jesus has been punished because God really did that. God wanted his death and wanted his crucifixion and so on. So she refutes that and said, well, that God's wrath should be vented upon his beloved son is divinely unnatural. Such a theory is man-made. So she refutes that and says, actually, what is going on is that constant self-sacrifice. So Jesus sacrificed himself in order to prove life, and not because God put, what would you say, that God has wrath on him or vented. Oh, now my English is not good enough. Huh? Yeah. I think I have to say it the way it is put here. What did we have with vented on him? Yeah, that God's wrath should be vented on Jesus. That's the theological view. The scientific view is that Jesus himself wanted to sacrifice his mortal sense of things. That was not the wrath of God, that crucifixion. Now that such a theory is man-made. The atonement, therefore, is a hard problem in theology. So this is all refuting theology, and we come back really to our subject. But its scientific explanation is that suffering is an error of sinful sense. So if Jesus suffered, that was still the suffering of a sinful sense. We have seen at the beginning of our talk that Jesus suffered and suffered for the sins of the world because he has not yet freed himself completely from a material sense of existence. He still took part in the earthly origin of him, and therefore had to go through that suffering until to lay down through constant immolation every vestige of error. Yes, so that suffering is an error of sinful sense which truth destroys, and that eventually both sin and suffering will fall at the feet of an everlasting love. Now, when we read that, then we cannot really, honestly, in our heart, interpret it as soul, as life, this last sentence. If we are really honest to the text and honest to the interpretation, we must say, no, this is no more the tone, really the main tone of soul as life. Actually, and that she does from time to time, actually, when she takes up the subject of life, she very often combines it right away with truth and love, because life, truth, and love are always the form of demonstration. And so, in a way, we must interpret these last few lines as being a forecast of what's coming? Is that the right term? Anticipating what is coming, namely quickly saying that soul as life leads then to soul as truth and soul as love. Let's see it again at line 7. The atonement is a hard problem in theology. Well, let's put that away, that's okay. Now, what is the scientific explanation? Is that suffering is an error. You can see it once now, she says. She goes further and says, actually, suffering is an error of sinful sense that could be met with what? Not with life here. Now she goes on to truth, that is an error of sinful sense, which truth destroys, and that eventually, the moment you have eventually, you always have the last tone of love, that eventually both sin and suffering will fall at the feet of everlasting love, at the feet of love, but everlasting, so as to accentuate again the tone of life. Did I make myself clear about this? That we must not be too strict in the text and say, well, a tone just goes to this full stop, or to this comma, or to this the end of this paragraph. A writer always is flexible enough that he also takes in already the end of it, that he uses the flow of a thought and writes it that way. And here she has done that rather clearly to show what is soul. Soul is freeing ourselves from sin and leading us to soul, to salvation. How is that way from sense to soul brought to salvation at the point of life? It's brought to the constant sacrifice of sin and self. That's life. But if we do that, why should we do that? Why do we suffer? Because that suffering, that self-sacrifice, is anyway an error. And that error is a counterfeit of truth. That truth must destroy, so that the end product is that both sin and suffering must fall at the feet of everlasting love, a nice tonality of life and love. But this further two subtones of truth and love are then taken up again and explained explicitly. So we come to soul as truth. And when we come to soul as truth, then we will find something which we see here, that truth is always that which rebukes error, and rebukes error through spiritual understanding. That's truth. So let's see how she explains it. She says, rabbinical law said, he that taketh one doctrine firm in faith, now you have another firmness, but firm in faith, firm in believing, not firm in truth, not firm in spiritual understanding, but if you are just firm in blind faith, has the Holy Ghost dwelling in him. This preaching receives a strong rebuke. So she rebukes the rabbinical wisdom, which said that if you take a doctrine firm in faith, that then you have the Holy Ghost within yourself, that this receives a strong rebuke. So, in the scripture, namely by saying, faith without works is dead. So now you get the works again as truth. In truth, 6 days thou shalt work, do all thy work. That's a sixth statement in the commandment. Can you see, constantly we can fall back to the days of creation, or to the commandments, or to the Beatitudes, or to the Lord's Prayer. If we know those as a good ground, good foundation in our consciousness, we are helped already quite a bit. So she gives a positive sense of it and the negative sense. First, the negative sense again, faith, if it be mere belief, is a pendulum. When we come back to the pendulum, say, actually, when we vibrate, if we see something in us that vibrates, we know that we are not standing on truth, that we are standing on a belief. That our foundation is a belief and not really understanding. So faith, if it be a mere belief, is as a pendulum swinging between nothingness and something having no fixity. Can you hear the counterfeit of soul? As truth, having a false foundation. And now comes the positive, but faith, again taking the same term, but faith advanced to spiritual understanding. Spiritual understanding, if we know the third degree, then we know spiritual understanding is the third term, symbolizing soul. Advanced to spiritual understanding is the evidence gained from spirit, which does what? Which rebukes sin of every kind. And you see now spiritual understanding as soul rebukes really sin of every kind, because that's the way that truth destroys error, and establishes what? The truth, the claims of God. We know that truth is that which affirms itself, which claims itself, which is conscious of itself, which is aware of itself, and so shows that on one side we have faith as blind belief, which gives us a vibrating sense, an unbalanced sense of our lives, whereas if we reject sin on the basis of faith, that is spiritual understanding, that is firm, spiritual understanding is a firm understanding, that then we establish the truth, the claims of God. And that brings us to the next subtone of love. She elaborates further on that term faith and gives it a higher connotation. In Hebrew, Greek, Latin, and English, faith and the words corresponding thereto have these two definitions. Either they mean trustfulness or trustworthiness. So these two are terms that have to be seen in their meaning. They have two different meanings. So she says, one kind of faith, which is trustfulness, trusts one's welfare to others. So this is a wrong sense of being constant and to be firm, to be reliant, firmly reliant, because it relies on somebody else. The welfare and trusts our welfare to others. Another kind of faith, that would be trustworthiness. Another kind of faith understands divine love and how to work out one's own salvation. Can you see, all again and again she comes back to working out one's own salvation, because that's the way from sense to soul. So love, really, if we understand love, that shows how to work out one's own salvation with fear and trembling. That's a quote from the Bible. Many translators say it should read, work out one's own salvation among or amidst fear and trembling, which is even a better sense than with fear. Would mean that you have to fear in order to work out salvation. It means that you have to tremble and that your knees must be shaking in order to work out your own salvation. The sense would be much better when we read it differently, because that's what we really experience. We fear and tremble and say, even with that consciousness, we must find our way out, and in spite of trembling and fearing, we work out our own salvation through spiritual understanding. So she goes on and depicts again that false sense of faith and says, Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief, expresses the helplessness, that's the counterfeit of trustworthiness, expresses the helplessness of a blind faith. Whereas, and now comes the positive sense of it, whereas the injunction, believe, and thou shalt be saved demands now a self-reliant trustworthiness. Can you just hear in this rendering of self-reliant trustworthiness? Trustworthiness she has depicted as that we can trust love, that love is worthy to be trusted in the face of fear and trembling, and it is a self-reliant. You don't rely on a person, on a mediator, but you work it out yourself. So self-reliant again has a sense of soul. So self-reliant trustworthiness is a wonderful description of soul as love, which includes what? Now she depicts it and says it includes spiritual understanding. That's really when we can be self-reliant. When we have a spiritual understanding, we stand on such firm ground that nothing can shake us, that we are not shaken by the testimony of the senses, that we are not shaken by fear and trembling, that we really, in spiritual understanding, we really have firm ground under our feet. And in that spiritual understanding, what do? We trust and confide all to God. And therefore, instead of God, you could have said love, because that's the nature of love, that we can confide everything to love, because we know that love wants to save everything. So it gives that climax sense here in the tone of soul, which really says we work out that way from sense to soul. We really work out our salvation then when we trustfully can rely on spiritual understanding, soul, and that reliance on spiritual understanding trusts everything in God, because spiritual understanding always understands something about God and not something about the mortal or anything else. Again, she elaborates on that point. The Hebrew verb to believe means also to be firm. Again, you have the tone of soul, to be firm, or to be constant. Again, the tone of soul. This certainty applies to truth and love understood and practiced. Again, it's a self-reliant spiritual understanding that confides all to God. And therefore, firmness in error, that's the opposite, firmness in error will never save. It's never a salvation. We'll never save from sin, sickness and death. That's the other side of the coin, which shows really that firmness in error cannot save, whereas spiritual understanding can save, really accomplishes or fulfills the way of salvation. Yes. Okay, we put that text away again and go back to an overall view and ask ourselves again now, what have we learned here? And we say, is there a clear-cut, logical flow of ideas going through that subject? We come again to the developing sequence. Just never don't forget that. If you don't go over those developing sequences, your consciousness will never be cultured into the category of the word order, of seeing that the word order is a Genesis order, is a logical order, and that sequence is scientific. So the subject of soul is that there is a way from sense to soul, that the Christ demands that we go the way from sense to soul, and we can ask ourselves, what is necessary to see? If I don't start out with mind, I have no guide to bring me from sense to soul. If I don't start out with that divine mind and I start out with opinions and some kind of a human wisdom or human intellect, I don't start out rightly, and I will always vibrate, and I will journey eastward and westward and eastward and westward. I will have no true guide. So I let the divine mind tell me how to work out my own salvation. And so I rely on that divine mind, which says, you know, the divine mind is also spirit. If you rely on that divine mind guidance, you will make progress. And so we had the tone of spirit, which showed us that that will make progress, that that has success, and we will be freed from the danger of retrogression, of going backward. But soul says, that's fine if you do that. But if you can see that that you have to rely on the guidance of mind, which alone brings success and brings unfoldment, you have to stick to that very line. The rule of soul says, stick to it, don't go back to it, be not a sluggard, persevere in it, and you will win the crown. Though it may take many stages, though love is not hasty to deliver you, though you may have to stick again and stick again and stick again, little by little, then love will give you the answer. And at that point, we see that this is something that we have to do ourselves, that this is a principle that is our principle, and that we cannot put it over to somebody else and say, do it for me. Principle says, reflect that principle and go that way from mind to spirit to soul yourself. Work out your own salvation. And so gives the sense of principle, demonstrating it ourselves. If we have seen that we have to do it, then the question comes, well, at the point of life, then I have to lay down the mortal sense of things. Then I cannot just say, God, mercy, mercy on me, without any justice, without any work. I have to work. And not just always beg to God, have mercy on me. I have to do something. And that doing is the constant self-immolation, so that I don't carry with me a mortal sense of things and try to go into heaven with a mortal sense of things. But that I am constantly aware I have to lay down the various suggestions of mortal consciousness, of the mortal belief, and get over them and leave them behind me so that I can run and go forward. Only in that way we can overcome error. And so we come to truth, which says, only if I do that and rebuke sin, I can really establish the claims of God, I can really establish my true manhood. And especially if I see that in my steadfastness, I trust everything into God, that I build on spiritual understanding, which understands what God is, and then and be constant in that, that will do the job, that will do the trick, and I will be saved. That's the line of reasoning there. Now, you always lean back and go over it again. And every time you go over it, don't go over it in the same terms, go over it in the same tonality. And every time, if I would start right away again, but I am not allowed to do that because of the tape, I would say it a little bit different, but still keeping really to the tonality of it.